He wasn't just fast, he made time Neo. From a barefoot boy racing goats through the hills of Jamaica, to the world's greatest sprinter who danced before the gun and smiled through the storm. Usain Bolt didn't just break records, he rewrote what humans believed was possible. But behind the gold medals and roaring stadiums lies a deeper story of pain, pressure, failure, and faith. This is not just the tale of a man who ran faster than anyone in history. This is the legacy of lightning and what happens when it stops. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Usain Bolt, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, Fire and Falter. Failure has a sound. It's not always a bang or a shout. Sometimes it's a whisper, a subtle shift in the way people say your name. It's the silence that follows a disappointing race. It's the tight smile from a coach who used to grin without restraint. It's the sound of a nation no longer chanting your name, but questioning it instead. After the Athens Olympics in 2004, Usain Bolt returned to Jamaica not as a national hero, but as a cautionary tale. He was just 18 years old, tall, awkward, and still reeling from a first-round Olympic elimination that had left a stain on his once sparkling rise. The injury had robbed him of his stride, but public memory doesn't make room for context. It only remembers the scoreboard. The headlines were not kind. Bolt breaks down. Teen phenom fizzles. And cruelest of all, too tall, too soft, too late. Even in Sherwood content, where neighbors had once called him the Lightning Boy, the conversations shifted. Not out of malice, out of doubt. He was fast, yes, but maybe not built for the world stage. He's good, but maybe he peaked too early. The words found their way to him. They always do. Fame is porous. It doesn't shield you. It opens you up. And when you fall, it makes sure everyone hears the echo. Usain didn't talk much in those months. He still trained, still jogged laps, still showed up to meets. But his heart wasn't in it. His body ached in ways that no one else could see. The scoliosis that twisted his spine whispered through every stretch, every stride. The hamstring strain that had haunted him in Athens kept flaring up, sometimes without warning. He smiled in public. He waved at fans. But in private, he began to wonder whether the world had been wrong about him. Or worse, whether it had been right all along. The fire was flickering. But fire never dies completely. It just needs fuel. And that fuel arrived in the form of Coach Glenn Mills. Mills wasn't the kind of coach who shouted. He didn't believe in fear. He believed in facts, in fundamentals, in form. He had guided some of Jamaica's finest sprinters and knew the difference between hype and promise. When he looked at Bolt, he didn't see a broken prodigy. He saw a masterpiece covered in dust. He invited Usain to train at the Racers Track Club, an elite group that trained in Kingston under a strict but nurturing regime. There, Mills laid down the law, not in bark commands, but in quietly unmovable expectations. "If you're coming here," he said, "then we start from zero. Forget Athens. Forget the medals. Forget the noise. I don't want the boy who ran fast. I want the man who understands why he runs." Usain hesitated. He was used to things coming easy. His raw talent had carried him further than most could dream. But now he was being asked to start over, to unlearn bad habits, to humble himself, to accept that talent was no longer enough. He agreed. The first weeks at Racers were grueling. They stripped his form down to its core, correcting his stride, shortening his ground contact time, adjusting the way his arms moved with his hips. Glenn Mills was meticulous, almost surgical in his coaching. He studied Bolt's biomechanics, like a sculptor studying marble. And it wasn't just physical. Mills imposed discipline. Early mornings. Clean eating. Mental focus. "You don't have to love pain," he told him one day after a particularly brutal hill sprint. "You just have to respect it." There were days when Usain wanted to walk away. Days when his back spasms brought tears to his eyes. Days when the weight of expectations felt heavier than his own frame. But somewhere in the blur of pain and repetition, something new began to take shape. Maturity, not the kind that comes with age, the kind that comes with failure, the kind forged in silence, in sweat, in solitude. He began to take recovery seriously. He began to study his rivals, not just their races, but their lives. He watched videos of Michael Johnson, marveling at the upright elegance of his form. He analyzed Carl Lewis, paying attention to how he burst from the blocks with intention. And slowly, Usain started to shed the skin of the boy the world had given up on. But even as the fire returned, doubt was not done with him yet. In 2005, Bolt competed in the World Championships in Helsinki. It was meant to be his redemption arc, his moment to silence the critics. But fate, once again, had other plans. He pulled his hamstring in the 200-meter quarterfinals. Another DNF. Another round of headlines. Another round of doubts. Somewhere between the ice baths and the sleepless nights, Usain began to face a terrifying question. What if I'm cursed? He didn't say it aloud, but it haunted him. He went quiet again. But Coach Mills didn't give up on him. This is the last time you let failure define you, he told him sternly. You are not your injury. You are not your press clippings. You are what you decide to become when no one is watching. It wasn't a speech. It was a challenge. In 2006, a shift occurred. Glenn Mills made a bold move. He suggested Bolt begin training not only for the 200 meters, but for the 100 meters. At first, Usain laughed. I'm too tall for that, he said. Short guys run 100. Not me. But Mills wasn't joking. You're not too tall, he said. You're just not used to running it properly yet. The idea was radical. Bolt had always been seen as a 200-meter specialist. His long limbs took time to unfold, and the 100 meters required explosive starts. But Mills saw something no one else did. He saw potential for evolution, for transformation. And so Bolt began again. New training, new drills, new pain. He worked on his starts, learning how to coil his tall frame like a spring. He studied acceleration mechanics. He watched frame-by-frame videos of his own races, grimacing at his sloppy launches and inconsistent foot placements. He hated it at first, but soon he began to find rhythm in the new challenge. He wasn't just running anymore. He was building something. Something terrifying. Something beautiful. Something fast. By the end of 2006, Bolt had finished second at the IAAF World Athletics Final, behind Tyson Gay, one of the fastest men on the planet. But more importantly, he had finished healthy. For the first time in years, he was racing without injury, without fear, without collapse. And in the quiet after the meet, Glenn Mills told him something that would stick forever. You're almost ready. Usain didn't ask, ready for what? Because he already knew. He was ready to reintroduce himself to the world. Not as the boy who failed, but as the man who fell, rose, and now was preparing to fly. Chapter 6, Reinvention Through Pain. Change rarely arrives in the form of triumph. It doesn't sweep in with fireworks or applause. It creeps, quiet, slow, painful, through repetition, resistance, and raw, unromantic struggle. Reinvention isn't glorious. It's grueling. And for Usain Bolt, it came not in the heat of competition, but in the lonely hours before dawn, on empty tracks where the world wasn't watching. By 2007, Usain was no longer the wide-eyed boy with nothing to prove. Nor was he the wounded teen still reeling from Athens. He was somewhere in between, a man being reassembled, muscle by muscle, belief by belief, breath by breath. Coach Glenn Mills had become more than a coach. He was now mentor, craftsman, and surgeon of spirit. Together, they begun re-engineering the very foundation of Bolt's identity, stripping him of everything casual, everything that made him merely fast, and reshaping him into something deliberate, something dangerous. The 100 meters, once an afterthought in Bolt's career, now took center stage. He had always preferred the longer sprint, where he could ease into rhythm and open his stride. But the 100? That was war. Brutal. Explosive. Unforgiving. No room for recovery. No time for error. Every millisecond mattered. So, they started from scratch. The body rebuilt. The first step was posture. Bolts naturally slouched. Loose gait made him a joy to watch, but a nightmare at the start. His tall frame worked against him in the first 30 meters of a sprint. He was too slow out of the blocks. His reaction time needed refining. His launch was inefficient. So Coach Mills attacked the problem with surgical focus. Day after day, they practiced arts, drills, hill sprints, resistance training. Bolt would crouch into starting position 100 times a session, launching forward into the silence of the morning air. Over and over, until the muscles in his glutes screamed, until his legs felt like concrete, until his lungs burned with every breath. There were no cameras, no fans, no reporters, only sweat, only repetition, only discipline. "You can't fake the first 30, Mills would say. "You have to earn them." They rewired his movement patterns, adjusted the angles of his stride, shortened his ground contact, taught his body to fire like a spring, compact, explosive, precise. Bolt began working with physiotherapists who focused on correcting his scoliosis-induced imbalances, rebuilding his core strength from the inside out. Everything hurt, all the time. He gritted his teeth through deep tissue massages that felt like punishment. He lifted heavier weights than ever before. He added yoga to his routine, forced his long limbs into uncomfortable poses in order to create balance where imbalance had ruled. He even changed the way he ate. Gone were the carefree snacks and junk food. Coach Mills brought in nutritionists who introduced structured meal plans, hydration schedules, and supplementation. Bolt reluctantly let go of some of his old habits, though the occasional chicken nugget would still sneak in as comfort after brutal sessions. But none of it came naturally. It wasn't in his DNA to be rigid. It wasn't in his personality to be obsessed. He loved laughter. He thrived on ease. So why did he stay? Because he'd felt what it was like to fall. And now he wanted to rise. The mind refocused. What surprised Bolt the most wasn't how hard his body could be pushed. It was how much his mind had to evolve to keep up. He began watching films of sprinters, the way musicians study great compositions. Frame by frame, he analyzed Asafa Powell's starts, Maurice Greene's finishes, Tyson Gay's transitions. He became a student of the sport. He even studied himself, painfully dissecting his own poor performances from years past. He watched himself falter, fade, fall. And with every replay, he took notes. Coach Mills made it clear, "If you don't understand why you lost, you'll never know how to win." So Bolt began journaling. Every race, every training session, every tweak in strategy, every change in breathing pattern, every emotion he felt at the start line. This was new territory. He wasn't just training his legs, he was building a blueprint for legacy. And with each entry, the doubt that had once filled his lungs began to thin out. What remained was clarity. The fire returns. In the spring of 2007, Bolt entered the Charifta Games as a man transformed. He wasn't at his peak, not yet, but the signs were there. His strides were sharper, his energy cleaner. His start still lagged behind the shorter sprinters, but what followed was breathtaking. He could close the distance in a flash, a blur, a bolt. He won the 200 meters with ease. But it wasn't the win that mattered, it was the effort. He no longer coasted through races on talent alone. He fought for every meter. He ran with intention. And Coach Mills knew the new Bolt had arrived. But the test was still to come. The Osaka Proving Ground. In August 2007, the IAAF World Championships were held in Osaka, Japan. It was Usain Bolt's return to the global spotlight. The last time he'd appeared on this stage, he'd been a teenager pulling up injured. Now he was back with something to prove, not just to the world, but to himself. He entered the 200-meter event. No longer the rookie, no longer the question mark, but still not the favorite. He faced off against Tyson Gay, the American powerhouse who had emerged as the world's fastest man. Bolt, though stronger and sharper than ever, still had nerves clawing at his ribs. And in the final, those nerves cost him. He stumbled slightly in the turn. Recovered too late. He finished second. A silver medal. To most, it was a triumph. To Bolt, it was a promise left unfinished. In the post-race interview, he didn't celebrate. He didn't blame the stumble. He just stared into the camera and said, "Next time." Coach Mills put a hand on his shoulder later that night. "That wasn't a loss," he said. "That was the last lesson." A silent vow. That night in Osaka, Bolt sat alone in his hotel room, knees up, headphones on, staring out at the neon skyline of a city that didn't yet know who he really was. He thought about every injury, every early loss, every headline that had doubted him. And somewhere beneath the calm surface, something ancient stirred. A hunger, a storm. He made himself a silent vow, not out of rage or revenge, but out of destiny. "I will become the fastest man the world has ever seen. Not because of talent, not because of luck, but because he had earned it." And back in Kingston, as the sun began to rise over the racers' track club, Glenn Mills set out cones on the empty track. He knew Usain would be there before the clock struck seven, because something had changed. The boy who once ran for fun now ran for immortality. The fire had returned, and this time, it was unstoppable. Chapter 7, Beijing, the birth of a legend. There are moments in life when time bends, when the clock ticks normally for everyone else, but for one person, for one soul tuned to a higher frequency, the world slows to a crawl. The air thickens. The ground pulses. The silence before impact becomes symphonic. August 2008, Beijing, China. The Bird's Nest Stadium stood like a woven crown of steel and shadow, humming with a breath of 91,000 spectators. The world had gathered not just to witness Olympic glory, but unknowingly, to watch history be rewritten. And somewhere deep beneath those flashing lights, past the media rooms, past the layers of security and ceremony, Usain Bolt sat alone, lacing up his golden Puma spikes. He wasn't just about to run a race. He was about to become a myth. The calm before the thunder. The road to Beijing had been paved with quiet fire. After his second place finish in Osaka the year before, Bolt had thrown himself into training with monastic focus. His diet was tighter, his recovery stricter, his mind sharper. Coach Glenn Mills had continued the meticulous overhaul of Bolt's sprinting mechanics. The 100 meters had gone from an afterthought to an obsession. Every start, every stride, every breath had been examined, broken down, rebuilt. He learned how to stay low out of the blocks, how to manage the stagger between reaction time and top-end speed. He learned how to channel that raw energy without losing his rhythm. But even then, no one knew what he was about to do. Not fully. Not yet. In May 2008, just 3 months before the Olympics, Bolt had stunned the athletics world by running a 9.76-second 100 meters in only his fifth professional race at the distance. A month later, at the Reebok Grand Prix in New York, he broke the world record, running 9.72 seconds in near-perfect form. And still, he wasn't done. The world now expected gold. But no one could predict what was coming, because not even Bolt knew. The final countdown. The Beijing Olympics began under a red and golden sky, with fireworks that painted the heavens and drums that echoed across continents. It was a spectacle of beauty, power, precision. But in the heart of it, something simple, almost ancient, was unfolding. A man was preparing to run. The 100 meters, the shortest event in the games, would become the loudest. The buzz began days before the final. Commentators whispered about Bolt size, about whether his 6 feet 5 inches frame was a liability at the start. Pundits speculated that his height made him better, suited for the 200. They doubted his consistency, his nerves, his inexperience. But Bolt didn't listen. He danced. He smiled. He walked into every heat and semi-final like he was arriving at a block party in Kingston. His confidence wasn't arrogance, it was freedom. Because he knew something they didn't. He was no longer running for approval. He was running for joy. And joy, when untethered, is the most dangerous force in the world. The 100-meter final, August 16, 2008. The stadium was breathless. The 8 men on the track were still. The camera panned across them, faces locked in grim concentration. Except one. Lane 4, Usain Bolt. He clapped his hands. He beat his chest. He smiled like a boy who'd snuck into a king's court. The gunman raised the pistol. Set. Bang. And then time shattered. Bolt surged from the blocks, not first, not cleanest, but strong enough to stay close. At 30 meters, he was even. At 50 meters, he pulled ahead. At 70 meters, he was gone. At 80 meters, he opened his arms. He thumped his chest. He looked side to side. He smiled at the world as it tried to catch him. He finished in 9.69 seconds. With his shoelace untied, the world stopped. The stadium exploded. The man who had once been written off, who had pulled up in Athens, who had doubted his own body, had just run faster than any human in history. And he did it like it was a game. Shockwaves around the world. The race went viral before the night was over. Millions replayed the clip, not just for the time, but for the audacity of it. Who thumps their chest mid-race? Who looks sideways during an Olympic final? Only someone who knows he is rewriting the laws of motion. The pundits scrambled. Some said he could have run 9.6 flat if he hadn't celebrated. Others called it disrespectful. But for most of the world, it was something else entirely. Joy. Freedom. Black excellence incarnate. Usain Bolt had not just won a race. He had transformed the 100 meters from a discipline into a performance art. The 200 meters. The double. 4 days later, Bolt returned for the 200 meters, the race that had once defined him. This time, there was no laughter before the start. No dancing. No theatrics. Just focus. Because he knew, winning the 100 was legend. Winning the 200 would be immortality. He stormed out of the blocks, powered through the bend, and exploded down the straight. 19.30 seconds. Another world record. He had broken Michael Johnson's untouchable mark, a record many believed would stand for decades. Bolt didn't just break it, he obliterated it. The 4x100-meter relay, the triple. Then came the final test, the relay, Team Jamaica, for men. One mission, Bolt ran the third leg, typically a strategic choice for someone with his turn speed. He blazed through his curve like a force of nature, handing the baton with such precision that the anchor barely had to decelerate. 37.10 seconds. World record. Gold again. In one Olympic Games, Usain Bolt had achieved the triple crown. Gold in the 100 meters. Gold in the 200 meters. Gold in the 4x100-meter relay. All in world record time. No man had ever done it. No man had ever looked so effortless doing it. The legend is born. Back in Jamaica, the streets shut down. People danced in the streets. Radios played Bob Marley and Buju Banton. Children ran barefoot in celebration, mimicking the lightning bolt pose. He wasn't just a hero. He was an idea now, a symbol of what was possible. World leaders sent congratulations. Athletes bowed their heads. Reporters searched for words. And Bolt? He kept smiling. He kept laughing. He reminded everyone that yes, he trained hard. Yes, he struggled. But at the end of the day, me run for fun, man. But the world would never be the same again. Because on August 16, 2008, in 9.69 seconds, Usain Bolt didn't just win gold. He changed the way the world saw speed. He brought joy back to competition. He reminded us that greatness doesn't have to scowl or grind its teeth. Sometimes greatness smiles. And from that moment forward, the race was no longer about who was the fastest. It was about who could run like lightning and still remember to dance. Chapter 8, The Way to Glory. Glory is not light. It dazzles, yes. It shines. It wraps you in the applause of millions. But it also presses down on your shoulders like iron. The moment the fireworks fade and the interviews end, glory whispers questions that fame cannot answer. Can you do it again? Can you stay at the top? Can you survive the weight of being what others now expect you to be? In the months that followed the 2008 Beijing Olympics, Usain Bolt didn't just return to Jamaica as a hero. He returned as something larger than life. Statues were proposed. Streets renamed. Children born that year were nicknamed Bolt by proud parents. The government threw celebrations that stretched across the island. Rastafarian elders called his gift divine. Dancehall artists dropped his name into lyrics. From Kingston to Montego Bay to the hills of Trelawney, he wasn't just a man who ran fast. He was a son of the soil who defied gravity. And yet, beneath all the praise, beneath the cameras and the medals and the parties, Bolt was discovering the truth. Fame is not fuel. Fame is fire. And if you're not careful, it can burn through the very joy that started it all. The world wanted more. The Beijing Games had created an insatiable appetite. The world had never seen anything like him. Tall, fluid, smiling mid-race, pounding his chest while his competitors still ran behind him. He had broken not just world records, but the rules of performance. Now every country, every brand, every journalist, every fan wanted more. He was no longer just an athlete. He was a global commodity. Nike wanted him. Adidas wanted him. Puma, the underdog brand that had sponsored Bolt since his teenage years, now found themselves in the spotlight. They signed a $9 million endorsement deal with Bolt, then the highest paid track athlete in history. Other sponsorships followed. Gatorade, Virgin Media, Hublot, Digicel. His face was on billboards in Times Square, in Tokyo, in London. His name became a brand. Bolt was no longer a runner. He was an icon. And icons are not allowed to fail. The burden behind the smile. Usain never stopped smiling. He danced at press events. He cracked jokes in interviews. He was photographed at parties with celebrities and models, turning heads with his charm and ease. But behind the smile, the pressure mounted. Coach Glenn Mills noticed it first. Usain, once casual and carefree, was becoming distracted. Not in a way that could be seen in one race or one training session, but subtly, like the slow unthreading of a fabric stretched too thin. "He's carrying the world," Mills said quietly to a colleague. "And the world is heavy." Training began to feel different, more obligatory, less joyful. The media followed his every move. Reporters speculated about his nightlife habits. Rumors swirled. Was he partying too much? Was he serious enough? Could he maintain his edge? At a meet in Zurich, just weeks after Beijing, Bolt slipped at the start and finished the race, holding his hamstring. He limped off the track with clenched teeth. The headlines were immediate. Is the Bolt era already fading? The same voices that had once crowned him were already poised to take the throne away. But Bolt knew better than to panic. He'd learned his lesson in Athens. Pain was part of the process. Setbacks didn't define him. He returned to Jamaica, took a short break, and quietly regrouped with Mills. "We rest now," Mills said, "and then we rebuild stronger." Bolt agreed, but with one caveat. "I want to enjoy this," he told his coach. "I can't be great if I don't love it." So they found a new rhythm, one that balanced intensity with joy, discipline with freedom. It wasn't perfect, but it worked. A new role, ambassador of joy. In the midst of all this, Bolt began to understand something deeper. He wasn't just representing Jamaica anymore. He was representing the possibility of joy in sport. At a time when track and field was under siege from doping scandals, corruption, and falling public interest, Bolt was a breath of fresh, pure air. His performances were exhilarating not just because he won, but because he looked like he loved to win. He gave the world permission to believe again. And he knew it. He made a conscious choice to become the face of clean competition, of joy, of sportsmanship. He shook hands after races. He signed every autograph. He smiled for every fan. "I'm just doing what I love," he said. "And I want people to love it with me." He began working with youth programs in Jamaica, hosting clinics for young runners, showing up unannounced at schools to talk about the importance of balance, hard work, and heart. He didn't want kids to just idolize him. He wanted them to understand the journey. Because he hadn't forgotten Sherwood content. He hadn't forgotten the barefoot days. He hadn't forgotten who he was before the lights. And that was his greatest strength, the threat of complacency. But even legends aren't immune to drift. As 2009 approached, Bolt was still winning. But Mills noticed something unsettling. He was coasting. Not in races, but in preparation. The sessions were shorter. The focus less intense. He was still faster than most, but Mills saw what others couldn't. Bolt was relying too much on talent. So one day, Mills pulled him aside. "Usain," he said, "you're not chasing records anymore. You're defending them. And that requires more fire, not less." Bolt nodded. "I hear you, coach," he said. "I'm ready." And he was. Because deep down, Bolt was not afraid of hard work. He was afraid of losing that spark, the magic that made it all worth it. And so, they locked in again. Tighter routines. More intense drills. Recommitting to the process. The shadow of rivals. While Bolt trained, the rest of the world was gunning for him. Tyson Gay was sharpening his form, running some of the fastest times ever recorded. Asafa Powell, his Jamaican teammate, was still one of the most explosive starters in history. And soon, another name would rise. Johan Blake, a young Jamaican with terrifying speed and hunger. Bolt knew his throne wasn't secure. And for the first time, he began to understand what it meant to be the hunted. He had become the standard. And everyone else was measuring themselves against him. Legacy in progress. As 2008 gave way to 2009, Bolt had a decision to make. Would he settle into his legacy, or would he chase something greater? Something unprecedented? Something that even he didn't yet know he could achieve? He chose the latter, because he wasn't done. He wasn't satisfied. And more than anything, he wanted to run like he was still free, even under the weight of glory, even with the world watching, even as history leaned in, pen in hand.